I'll call this meeting to order. Meeting of the Higher Education Career and Readiness Policy and Finance Committee. We have minutes. Is that right? March 23rd, 2017. Anybody?
I would move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Good memory. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Before we have our presentations, we would probably like to take just one quick minute here to we have a few new faces. And probably we'll start with you, Princesa. Princesa is the new committee LA. Doing a fabulous job. Thank you. Welcome. And you all know Megan, perhaps, but Megan now is the committee administrator. And welcome. And then Lori, if you want to tell us anything, this is your one time.
I'm Lori Cousineau. I'm just a new House researcher for the Higher Education Committee, as well as the Civil Law Data Practices Committee. So this is my second hearing.
All right, thank you. Welcome. And we have a Paige who should introduce herself, too.
Hello. I'm Maddie Norgard. I grew up in North Minneapolis and most recently moved back here from Finland.
Oh. Welcome back. Yeah. So anyone, did I miss anyone? Connie, are you new?
No, I'm not new, but Princesa, is she new to the caucus? Because I don't know anything about her. Could she just say
maybe
a couple words? Yeah, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
If you want to give us your history.
My history.
Everything you need, that we need to know.
I come from the insurance industry, so this is my first time being here. I just started on February 1st. I'm not sure what else I should say.
Well, it must be more to that. Where did you
I live in Hopkins. I graduated from Hopkins High School.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
And let's see. That it? She worked for Farmers Insurance. Remember?
Oh,
they've seen that. They've done that. For whatever the slogan is.
Yes.
So we're glad to have her on board. Where did the cookies come from?
For me. I mean, I know. I'm hungry.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going this way, by the way.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is
they're
cake cookies, is my understanding.
Cake cookies.
Cake. Edina.
From Edina? Well, all right. Is there any other food in the building? Just to be clear. Yeah.
Burnt burritos up on fifth floor.
I'm thinking.
Too silly.
All right.
That was lunch.
Members,
I'm hungry.
One final note before we get into the testimony, and the testifiers are still here. Sorry to keep you waiting. At the end, if there's any time, we're going to ask everyone to repeat their summer adventures so we all know what you did last summer. So think about that. Hopefully we've run out of time, so we don't have to do that. So I'd right now like to invite our first testifier to come up, Larry Isaac from the Midwest Higher Education Compact. And some of you may be familiar with the Compact, but I'm guessing some of you are not. And this will be a chance for you to find out all about this really interesting higher education organization. So welcome, Larry, to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this on? Can you hear me?
Could be.
Okay. Good to be with you. I'm Larry Isaac. I'm the president of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. You have a folder that looks like this, or you should have a folder that looks like this, right? Oh, okay.
I think they're coming.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to, I'll start talking while those are being passed out. The Midwestern Higher Education Compact is headquartered here in the Twin Cities. In the information that we're going to share with you, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the organization and what we do, and the chair has asked me to also provide you with an overview of some policy indicators on how Minnesota is doing in various areas of education. So we will do that. By way of background, I'd also like to introduce Pam Shoot over here to my right. Pam and I have worked together for nearly 15 years. Both of us are retiring this year, and we're both from that state to the west of you. That's where we were born and raised. So,
I'm talking South Dakota, either, are you?
No, North Dakota. No, yeah, to the northwest of you, yes. I was chancellor of the university system there for several years and worked in higher education and state government, for 44 years now. So what is the compact? You'll have a document there that's coming. It's called the annual report. And if you look inside there, you will see a map, a red map on page 3. That is the states that comprise the compact. So what is an interstate compact? An interstate compact is an agreement among the states. It's a statutory agreement. Each of these 12 states has passed a statute to become a member of the compact. That means that you have agreed as states for the interstate compact to do things for and on behalf of the states. Of course, we are closely governed by the states and governed by a commission of five people from each state. So there's a 60-member board of directors. On the right-hand side of your document, you have the Minnesota highlights, and you'll see who the commissioners are from Minnesota. By statute, two of the commissioners have to be legislators. That's very unique to this compact. So there is heavy legislative involvement in the compact's governance, as well as then three people who are generally appointed by the governor of each state. And you can see who those are in Minnesota on that one sheet. The compact was created in 1991. It was an outgrowth of the Midwest Legislative Conference. It was really legislators that created the compact. There are four of these in the country. The other three were created in the 1940s and 1950s. This one was created in 1991 because there were actually legislative leadership from Minnesota at the time on the Midwest Legislative Conference said, you know, we're as a region, we're really not at the table in some discussions because we don't have a higher education compact that the other three regions of the country do. So the compact was created. Minnesota was one of the first states to pass the statute. And as I said, we have been in existence since 1991. A couple of more things about the compact and it and what we do. Each of the compacts works with states, legislators, policy groups, boards, commissions, and so forth and so on. But our commission early on said we want this compact to be different. We want it to have a unique niche. And as a result of that, our programs and what we do really have been very niche-oriented that helps students, institutions, and states. Once again, the state is the member of the compact, not institutions. The state is the member. And we do a number of things on behalf of the states that are approved by our governing board, obviously. But let me just talk about a few of those. One of the areas that we have really carved a niche in is in what we call cost savings contracts, where early on, the commission said, what can we do to save students money? What can we do to save institutions money and states money? We serve both public and not-for-profit institutions in states. And many school districts, counties and state governments and city governments can use our contracts. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. I think the best way to talk about the cost savings part is to go to pages 10 and 11 of that annual report. There's two spreadsheets there. And you will see the various areas that we have programs that are saving significant money for our states. In fact, in this last year, we hit a milestone. The savings for states and students and institutions surpassed $1 billion from the time we were created. and Representative Nornes, who's the commissioner and has been for several years, knows that those have been growing rapidly as the word gets out. But you'll see there we have a number of contracts in technology, and you'll also see on the right-hand side of your folder a list of all the entities that use those technology contracts. And you're going to see there the list is heavily populated with non-higher education enterprises and organizations, school districts, counties, cities, as well as both public and private nonprofit higher education. The savings to Minnesotans from using these programs, because when you go out and leverage 12 states, you can leverage some pretty good deals with some of these vendors like Dell and Oracle and others. In fact, these efforts have been so successful that the other three compacts came to MEC and said, gee, it'd be great if our institutions could take advantage of these. And we said, well, you can for a price. And so we now have contracts that cover 47 states. And so when you take that out to market, you can even get more leverage. But in the end, it saves our states even more money. We also have a property insurance program that over the years is now insuring close to $100 billion of property value at institutions. And that is saving millions and millions of dollars. University of Minnesota participated in that for many, many years. Over that time, they saved, about $15 to $16 million. A couple of years ago, they decided to go with another carrier. They had some challenges with loss history that impacted their coverage and so forth. We also have a student exchange program where students can go from state to state if a state decides to play in it. Everything that we have, it's voluntary for states, institutions to take part in. We can't tell anybody, you have to do this, you have to do that. It's all voluntary. And so we have a student exchange program that if states decide to join, then it's up to institutions in that state to decide if they want to participate. And what they agree to is they will charge students coming from other states in the agreement no more than 150% of resident tuition. Some institutions participate, some don't. 10 of our 12 states participate. And last year that saved Minnesota citizens. This is separate from reciprocity with North Dakota or Wisconsin. It saved Minnesota citizens $7.5 million. It is a program that is used by both incoming and outgoing. So those and one more area that I want to talk about that is saving your state a lot of money. 4 years ago, you were the fifth state who agreed to enter into what is called the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement. This is another service that the compact provides. In fact, all four compacts provide. In 2010, the U.S. Department of Education said that if you are Minnesota State Mankato, and you want to offer a program to a resident living in the state of Washington, you had to get approved by the state of Washington. And, oh, by the way, the state of Washington demanded or required a $750,000 bond, which cost $7,500. And if you wanted to offer that program to a citizen living in Alabama, you had to get approved in Alabama and Montana and on, every state. That rule had been on the books for a while, and it is a good rule because it is designed to protect against the fly-by-night institutions and offer consumer protection. But when the Fed said, and we mean it, as distance education exploded because of online education, institutions said, oh, my gosh, and we mean it meant if you don't get approved, you will lose your federal financial aid. That was the penalty. Well, institutions, of course, were concerned, but what I don't think the feds really understood was the cost that this was going to be incurred at institutions in personnel and just in fees. And so a number of national groups got together, suggested that a reciprocity agreement be created that would have certain standards that states and institutions had to meet and that once one state was in the agreement and another, you were approved back and forth. 4 years later, today, 49 states are participating. In my 44 years of government service and education, I have never seen an agreement take off like this. And it literally is saving institutions millions. We conservatively estimate that just in our 12 states, last year it saved nearly $15 million. And believe me, that is conservative. In Minnesota, most institutions are participating, saved them $1.5 million last year. So you can see what the savings are there. Last year in Minnesota, $11.6 million. Since you came into the compact, the savings have been about $82 million. The state pays an annual fee to be a member of the compact. It's $115,000. Hasn't changed. It's changed once in 10 years, and it will be frozen through 2021. We're very careful about that. We look at other revenue sources to help drive the organization, and our costs are about half of the other compacts to the states. So that's a real niche program. We do a number of other things. We have a student health insurance program. We are working on open educational resources right now to see what we might be able to do to add value in that area for institutions in our region. And we are also looking at an issue I know that you've talked about over the years, the credentialing of faculty to teach post-secondary education courses and the newly, well, not newly, the We Mean It mandate of the Higher Learning Commission a couple of years ago that said that you have to have 18 credit hours in your discipline to be able to teach that course. So a physics teacher could not teach an algebra course if they didn't have 18 credit hours in math, right? Our commission was very helpful there. Our commissioners, like Representative Nornes, became very concerned when this came up, and they got together, a number of them, and we were able to convince the Higher Learning Commission to let states and institutions have a waiver until 2022 so that they had time to implement this. Otherwise, they were going to enforce it within 9 months of announcing it, and it would have been devastating to some dual enrollment programs. So those are the kinds of things we work on, get involved in addition to all the other areas. I finally want to talk to you a little bit about policy. We do a number of things on policy research. For instance, we just issued a policy brief. If you're interested, it's on our website. You have programs in Minnesota that say, you know, if you go into teaching, you can get part of your loans forgiven. You have programs like that here, right, for some disciplines. So we took a look at, does it really work? Do these things really work? And it's about a three-page brief, and it will tell you, yes, they do work. They are making a difference. But what parts of them work better than others as well? So we do that kind of things for folks like yourselves and boards and commissions and others. One of the things we do that gets quite a bit of attention is a report on the right-hand side of your folder called Higher Education in Focus. This is a report we do every other year. This is a new one this year that looks at states and says, how are you doing on a number of policy indicators? Everything from attainment, preparation, finances, equity, student financial aid, affordability, and completion. All issues that every state and institutions are grappling with. I'm not going to go through the report page by page, but I'm going to highlight a couple of things for you if I could. A few years ago, you set a goal to have 70% of your adult population attain some type of post-secondary education certificate, degree, right? That's what Minnesota has declared, 70%. And to reach that by 2025. So what happens if you make it? This group went out and estimated what would happen to state revenues. What would happen in 2025 if you made it? You would have $1 billion in additional tax revenue to work with. That'd be pretty good. I used to be a budget officer in the state, so I would always welcome that news. And it would be generated through income tax, sales tax, property tax, Medicaid savings, and correction savings. A billion more if you hit that 70%, and I hope that those of us who live here in Minnesota, I hope we do. If you don't, if you stay right where you're at right now, you'll have about $30 million less, they project, by 2025 in revenues. You won't see the the other factors kick in. Just a few things. I read online on the Star Tribune just before I came over here that Minnesota hit 82% of public high school graduates or students graduating. And it was a very positive headline. And thank goodness. But, footnote on page 9. If you look at the graph, the region actually is doing a little better and nationally as well. So the competition is good. The reason that we put this report together is for this. And I said I'm not going to go through it all, but I want to tell you the reason for it. The competition for an educated citizenry is going to be intense. It is intense. There are worker shortages in professional programs, in technical programs, all through the spectrum. We hear about it all the time. The competition is going to be intense and even more intense, and I want to tell you this as policymakers, because that's why we put this report together for you to look at, to see where there are areas you can prove and get to that 70%. 75 million baby boomers are retiring. Now maybe 70. 70 to 75 million. I'm one of them, all right? At the same time, non-white births outpaced white births last year. You have two factors that are coming together right now that are going to seriously impact where are we going to get our educated workforce. You have a huge number moving out of the workforce in one way, and you have another demographic shift that has not been involved in post-secondary education as we have been to date with the current population. Those are going to significantly affect Minnesota's supply of an educated workforce and citizenry. Secondly, I want to encourage you to look at workforce development as everything higher education does, and that your conversations begin with, it's not about higher education. It's about ensuring that Minnesota has an educated workforce that will allow it to have a successful economy. To me, that is the issue in front of every state, region, county. And if you begin that discussion, your institutions then are there to serve the state, both public, nonprofit, to ensure that you can have that educated citizenry. They're not means an end unto themselves. Institutions are a means to that end, and they can help. Secondly, I want you to think about workforce development in the whole. It's everything colleges and universities do. Workforce development is not workforce training. Workforce development, you have institutions that produce doctors, teachers, welders, carpenters, accountants, lawyers, social workers, and on. All of those are workforce development. And I really like the name of your committee, Mr. Chair. I'll wrap it up there with the word career readiness in it as well. I think that does signal that you probably get it when it comes to the conversation that's needed. So that's what we do. Thank you, Minnesota, for being home to the compact. It happened because the University of Minnesota 28 years ago made a really good proposal that the commission decided to house us here. I'm glad they did. It's allowed me to live here for 15 years and in this great area of the country, and so we're always privileged to come here and meet with you.
Well, thank you for being with us today, and do you have anyone else?
No.
Okay.
No.
I then would ask committee members if they have any questions of Mr. Isaac. Representative Breyer, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. I would like to hear more about the graduation rates in Minnesota compared to the rest of the country. And I have something that, you know, I'm not sure you're able to answer offhand, but I talked to one of my high schools in the district, and one of the things they said is they actually hold students on after 4 years. And some of those students are English language learners, and some are in special need programs.
Right.
And so they actually are graduating them on time, but their time is 6 years.
Yeah.
And so does that, Is that, how would we compare then if a high, you know, if that's what we're doing in Minnesota?
You know, I don't know. I'll go back and check on that, but I don't know. Maybe someone else does. I don't know if they get included in the count or not.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, maybe they get included in that count for that year when they graduate, even if it is not 4 years, even if it is 6 years. But I'll find out.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
How are you doing on completion? That is an interesting issue that has received a lot of attention. But let me turn you to page 18. Starting on page 18 of the report, there's some charts and graphs there that show that. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at U.S. Department of Education data, it's going to show every state low. That's because if you are a student at again, Minnesota State Mankato, and you start off there as a freshman, and then you decide, oh, I'm going to transfer to St. Cloud, you're considered a dropout at Minnesota State Mankato by the federal government. You didn't complete. Well, you went over. So I don't, you know, we put these numbers out there, but I think the real numbers that you should be looking at are starting on page 19. And that is if you are actually transferring, okay? It's called a transfer-adjusted completion rate. And you can see 55% who started at a public two-year institution complete a certificate or degree within 6 years, and what they are for four-year public and what they are for four-year private, not for profits. All right, and you can see the comparisons with the MEC average, the U.S. average, and the top five median states. If you look at the next page, page 20, the transfer adjusted, if you started at Minnesota State Mankato, stayed there, and were full-time, if you were full-time, here is the completion rates in 6 years. So you can see what they are based on that. But as you know, there is a great deal of churn among students, moving among institutions, taking courses online from maybe multiple institutions. But if we look at it in the traditional sense, when I went to college a long time ago, that would be page 20, full-time and so forth. Although most of us made it out in 4 years then, there are a lot of different reasons why today, and I'm not judging, but that would have been the model when I graduated, and that's the model many times we think about in our heads, full, you know, and then, but we equate it to this non-transfer adjusted, or if you went, stopped out for a year and came back, I mean, you don't get counted.
Representative Albright, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Isaac, I find it curious, this graph at the top of page 8.
Page 8?
Yes, sir. And I'm wondering if we might just dwell on that graph a little bit. It's a bit of a paradox that, you know, we hear a lot about the need and or the increase in children enrolling in preschool, but yet the graph speaks to something quite different happening. I'm wondering if you could speak to how that, in your research, is what's the detail behind that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know the whys behind that. It's something you may want to look at. I will tell you it did take me by surprise, especially in Minnesota. There's been a slight drop and so forth. I believe this will rise over time as more and more states provide avenues for this, but it's been pretty, both in the region and nationally, it's been flat for, what is that, 7 years. I don't know all the whys for that, but it kind of surprised me, I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be inching up with all the attention that there has been, that it has been paid to it. Yeah. But I don't know why that is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Did you say how many employees you have here in Minnesota?
We have at any one time between 13 and 16. Yeah. So
that's quite small considering what you've been up to.
Yes, I'm told that by many of our groups. But I'll tell you why we're able to do as much as we do with that small staff. We get tremendous help and support from people out in the states, in higher education institutions, state government, all levels of institutions, community colleges, four-year college of research. At any one time, we will have over 200 people serving on committees that oversee all of these things we do. We don't think up anything ourselves. We let people out there come to us and do that. The greatest example of that I didn't mention is our military credit collaborative, where we're working with the 12 states to improve credit for veterans and active duty personnel. And it's really been going great, and Minnesota has a great story to tell in that area. And I hope when you look at the Office of Higher Ed, you'll hear that good story. You're doing a great job in that area.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always been my pleasure to come before your committee. You've always been most gracious. And
we'll see if we get you back one more time, just, you know, for old time's sake.
What's that?
I say we'll see if we can get you back one more time, I said before you.
Okay. All right.
Retirement isn't until November, right?
Until November.
Well, there's plenty of time then.
I guess there is. Thank you very much.
We'll see you. Thank you very much. All right. Next, we're going to have the Office of Higher Education. And we'll bring Larry on board another time because he thinks he got out of this, right?
Yes, he does.
Yeah. Nikki, you want to introduce yourself and then proceed.
I'm Nikki Oliver. I'm the Grants and Government Relations Manager for the Office of Higher Education.
Welcome.
So I guess I'm pretty much going to, I don't want to pound you guys over the head with another overview of our agency as we did that last year. So what I'm going to provide to you all is an update on programs that you either added or made adjustments to last session. That's okay.
And you have some handouts that we have all received.
So Chair Nornes, committee members, the first handout is an update on the state grant. Last session, the changes that were made was reductions to the assigned family responsibility by 10% on each of those areas, and setting the living and miscellaneous expense allowance to 101% of federal poverty. As you can see, the first page is just kind of a brief explanation of how the grant works. It's a need-based grant, as you all are aware of. Students complete the FAFSA application. It's the same process for the federal Pell Grant. Application deadline is 30 days after the start of the term, and there's no wait list. 86% of new entering resident undergraduates complete the FAFSA. It's for Minnesota residents attending Minnesota institutions. One-third of resident undergraduates receive a grant. Our current budget is about $198 million per year for the program. In fiscal year 2017, there was 146,000 applicants and a little over 81,000 recipients. So you can see about 56% of all students applying receive a grant. Minnesota is one of the few states that fully funds its program, and that's the reason for there being no waiting list. The next few pages are a bunch of slides with data and information regarding the grant, incorporating some of the changes that were made. On that third page, it reflects the state grant funding over time. In that first column, you can see what I've mentioned before, the number of applicants, the number of recipients. This chart also shows the amount of Pell and Minnesota state grant that was received. So there was a little over $410 million with federal Pell and state grant combined, and then it's also the amount of state grant that was received by the recipients and the average award amount. So about $2,290 a student will receive in state, has received in fiscal year 17 in state grant. After that, the next page breaks it down by sectors. So Men State's two-year, their four-year universities, University of Minnesota, the private nonprofit institutions, and the private for-profit institutions. And then the last chart is just over time, the average state grant awards. So I, there is a caveat. So we anticipate increasing the LME to 9,436 to fully utilize the remaining appropriation in this upcoming fiscal year, in this fiscal year coming up.
And that's done just automatically?
Yeah, that's the LME increase, yes. I'll stand for questions for any questions.
Okay. Could everyone follow that? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have for you is the on the income levels, it says 100,000 or more. The other ones are intervals of 10,000. How high does that 100,000 go to 110?
I'd have to ask our state grant manager, and I can get back to you on what the where that cutoff is.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
The next
proceed.
The next update is on over the child care grant. Last session, there were two change. There was an additional $20,000 provided to the grant.
Which document is that?
No. There's no handout for that one. I'll let you all know when there's a handout.
We'll stop looking
at that. Okay. The child care grant. So the two changes made were to the eligible to be eligible for the program under the old law, a resident student must have earned a degree at the level of the student's current course of study and must have been enrolled full-time at the level for at most 8 semesters or the equivalent. The change that was made last year was to change that 8-semester limit to 10 semesters for both undergraduate and graduate students. The other change was changing the max grant from $2,800 to $3,000. An update on the program. So fiscal year 17, we awarded a total of 1,775 students. 82 of those were graduate and professional students. Just to note, we sent out information to institutions that had professional and graduate students, and we didn't have any additional institutions apply to participate in the program, and we will still send out more information to try to get more of those institutions to participate in the program, so hopefully we'll see an increase in the graduate and professional students receiving the grant. We were given the authority to increase the federal poverty guidelines used for post-secondary child grant care maximum award chart based on income and household size. The previous chart was at 185% of poverty in 2016. We increased that to 200% of poverty for the 2017 federal poverty level. And the next pro, I don't know if there's questions for that program.
I don't know. Any?
It's just the numbers.
Representative Omar.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. Nikki, can you say those numbers again? 82 students in the graduate program, and then what was the undergraduate?
Yes. Sorry, I'm talking a little fast here. There's like a lot of programs to go through, so I'll slow down. For fiscal year 17, we awarded a total of 1,775 students, and 82 of those were graduate and professional students.
Thank you.
Yeah. Chair Nornes and committee, this also does not have a handout. the Summer Academic Enrichment Grant. Last year, we received an additional $25,000 a year, so a total of $50,000 for the biennium. As we mentioned last year, there's large waiting lists for this program. In fiscal year 17, we awarded a total of 899 students, and the max that a student can receive from our office is $1,000. The total award amount was $749,926. Some of that was surplus funding from other programs that we were able to transfer in to help mitigate some of that wait list for those students. In fiscal year 18, as of this month, we have received a total of 270 applications for an amount of $238,639. As I mentioned, our appropriation for this program is $125,000. So you can see that there will be a wait list for this and some students not receiving the funds. The next program, and this you do have in handout, that's the next handout. It's it should say Appendix A, Appendix B. This is for the Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injury Research Grant. Last session, this program received an additional $5 million, giving us a total appropriation of $6 million for the biennium. So in fiscal year 2018, due to timing of the legislative session and the annual spinal cord traumatic brain injury grant cycle, fiscal year 2018 funds were separated into two grant cycles, the annual research grant program and a supplemental funding grant. The annual research grant, we awarded a little over $1.5 million in June of 2017 to support 12 new research projects, 8 spinal cord injury and 4 traumatic brain injury projects. And that those are listed in Appendix A. You can see what those projects were. The supplemental funding that we just recently did, the purpose of it was to support projects that have already received initial funding from the state through the program. The funds are intended to expand and enhance these projects so that they can have a greater impact in the area of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research. We awarded a total of $862,829 in this month to support the expansion of 15 projects. 9 were spinal cord injury and 6 were traumatic brain injury, and that's in Appendix B.
Just one moment, I think at some later date we hope to have some of the recipients of this of these grants, or at least some of the folks from the spinal cord group, testify, because they have told me at least that they've had some pretty good results from that investment we made. So we'll hear them firsthand report that. So.
Great. And to speak on that, last month, some of those groups actually, they held a research symposium that Representative Albright actually attended and spoke at. There was no state money used for the symposium or its related activities. The Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Council and a small group of additional stakeholders coordinated the event, and it was held on the 31st of January. It was a half-day gathering, and five and 10-minute research sound bites were presented, and I think that's what they might have presented to you all at a later date as well. And it was a very successful event, and it was sold out, and it was great to see some of that research that this grant has funded. Yes. The next program update I have for you all, there's no handout for this one. It's regarding the Large Animal Veterinarian Loan Forgiveness Program, which the office received an additional $750,000 for. We contract this out to the Department of Health. They had 8 applicants, and they selected 5, and those 5 students are now under contract, and they will be in a 5-year program, and the Department of Health said it was a successful launch, and the School of Veterinary Medicine is who actually managed the actual application process. The next program, which does have a handout, is the Minnesota Teacher Candidate Grant. So the change made to this program was to expand the eligibility for grants to teachers in shortage areas, to teacher candidates belonging to underrepresented racial and ethnic groups. And as you can see in the handout, there's a breakdown of what the program is utilized for. Eligible students may receive up to $7,500 during one term, and they must be the term must be when students are completing a 12-week or more student teaching experience required for initial licensure. Initially, this program had got a one-time funding through the Education Committee, and it was put into our base funding for $500,000. The one-time funding was a little over $1 million. I can't remember the exact amount from the Education Committee. And the following pages are just more data on the number of applications, the number of eligible applicants and recipients, and dollar amounts. And then on the third page is a breakdown by campus of the funding and awards and students awarded.
Any questions? Okay. Proceed.
The next kind of category of things that I will talk about are OHE new responsibilities. The things that I mentioned previously were existing programs that got additional funding. So one of the major things that you all did last year was provide funding for the office to hire a campus sexual violence prevention and response coordinator. So we did hire someone. Her name is Melissa Kwan, and she's also willing to come testify in front of you all to give you more information on what she's doing. In January, some highlights from some of the work she's doing and will continue to do. She plans to hold regional listening sessions across the state. She's building a network across the state for campus sexual violence and prevention and response. She has planned and implemented a teen dating violence prevention month event to build sexual violence prevention capacity within OHE and raise awareness on our social media platforms. She is planning a sexual violence prevention month events in April. She's connecting with existing and developing sexual violence prevention efforts across campuses, university systems, nonprofit, community organizations, statewide coalitions, law enforcement, counties, regions, and statewide efforts. And she will also be helping put on a campus sexual violence prevention summit. What you all have as a handout was the news release, and that also provides a little more detail and background of who Melissa is and her work.
And we will meet her at some future date.
If you like.
Yes.
Sure. The next program I'd like to talk about is the Emergency Post-Secondary Grant. We received funding to establish a matching grant program for institutions to provide emergency funding to students experiencing food and housing insecurities and other short-term emergencies to kind of increase retention completion on campuses. You do have a slide handout for this, so that kind of goes through the high-level parts of the program. And the last sheet for that is the timeline for the RFP, which did go out in January, and we should be receiving actual proposals by March 2nd, so the end of this week. Just to give you some information, because it's limited funding, we did cap the amount each institution or grantee could receive at about, I think it's $40,000 for these emergency grants. we do have intent to submit from several colleges, and it's a wide range from Brainerd to Northfield, Austin, Rochester, Pine City, Bloomington, Mankato, and we even have two tribal colleges that have submitted intents to submit actual proposals for this funding. We in Wisconsin are the only state programs of its kind, so we've been getting a lot of interest in it nationally, actually. So we're excited to see what these proposals look like and to have more to report on to you all regarding it. Chair and committee, the next program is the Ag Educator Loan Forgiveness Program. There's no handout for this one. So we receive $100,000 a year in the base for the biennium in the base for Ag Educator Loan Forgiveness. We plan to collect applications for this program at the same time we open up the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness because they kind of overlap. Those who can qualify for this also should be able to qualify for the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program, so that's kind of why the manager of this wants to overlap the release date. Eligible applicants will be able to take advantage of both. There's nothing to stop them from taking advantage of both the programs if they qualify. The other program, loan forgiveness program, that we received from you all is the pilot and aircraft technician. We received $25,000 a year in the base for this program. And in late March or early April, we will hold an informational meeting with stakeholders to figure out the best time to open applications and how to best reach eligible applicants. Maybe it's through colleges, employers, or trade organizations. So those are forthcoming programs that we'd hopefully be able to update you all on later in session. The next two programs are legislatively named grants, so you guys directly told us who this funding is to go to. The first one is the Legal Education Debt Relief Grant, LREP, and it's a pass-through for loan repayment assistance for legal aid, not aids, but attorneys that help low-income folks. That grant contract was put in place in December. The next program is Minnesota Life College, which is an organization that helps individuals on the autism spectrum. And the funding was for need-based scholarships and tuition reduction for their program. They're not a post-secondary institution. And we received $2 million for the biennium in the base for this. A grant contract is in place, and we received the first request for payment this month. I don't know if there's questions.
We're keeping you busy.
Yeah.
Any questions? I guess keep moving ahead.
All right. Chair Nornes, committee members, the last program that I would like to update you all on is the Students with Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Grant. We received an appropriation of $400,000. Through research, we found that there were more than just Bethel that would qualify to participate in this program. There are actually three institutions, Bethel University, Central Lakes College, and Ridgewater College. The person managing this program held a work group discussion in January for all eligible programs. A draft policy and procedure manual will be provided to those campuses by March 5th for review and discussion, and initial grants are to be issued this fall.
There's a lot of support for that program,
mm-hmm.
for that idea.
Lastly, I'd like to update you all on some non-legislatively funding things that our office has been doing that I feel like you all would like to know about. The first is Minnesota Reconnect, and you guys do have the handout for this. And this is something our office, in partnership with Minnesota State, has launched with Lumina Foundation funding. And initially, it's to bring back adult learners that are close to completing college that have left. So They did put out an application process a while ago, and there's four participating campuses, institutions, Lake Superior College, Riverland Community College, South Central College, and Inver Hills Community College. And there's more information on the that can be found at these links regarding this program. So essentially it's a pilot, the grant from Lumina is contingent on how the pilot goes, and Penn State has input some money and funding in their own faculty and staff to do wraparound services for these individuals to make sure they actually complete once we get them back in. Then two more items regarding kind of around equity and attainment. So our office, in partnership with the Minneapolis Public Schools, in an effort to help the state meet its attainment goals, it was important that we broaden the college options for students to help and created a high probability of match and fit. Our relationship with the Common Black College application this year will allow students in the state of Minnesota to have access to up to 50 historical black colleges and universities. Students will be able to utilize the application to apply to select historical black colleges and universities for free. We launched it last year as well. I don't know if any of you had saw this flyer. We're going to do it again. So essentially, the students applied a common application for those. So today, we have 140 students from across the state who have engaged in the application. It is estimated that students have saved approximately $9,600 in application fees because of this. We also track to see if students have completed their FAFSA, and we will engage these students with an anti-melt programming through the next through text messages as well. So this is something that we're continuing to do. So I thought that would be something you all would like to know about. And also, this past October, our office with Lumina Foundation grant was able to bring the Center for Urban Education, that's from the University of Southern California here, and this is all regarding our the attainment goal and what we can do to move the needle here. So we secured a Lumina Foundation grant, and it was October 24th, and it was held at St. Paul College, where we hosted 10 Penn State institutions, four of which are the recipients of our equity grant that we received funding from the state. The central theme of the institution was to support campuses in producing equitable student outcomes. So the institutions had to bring their institutional researcher, a faculty member, and other people from their institution, and CUE basically informed them how to use the data to at their campus to move the needle and be more equitably minded in the work that they're doing. And I do have a list of all the Penn State institutions that attended, and we're doing follow-up work from that institution as well. So,
yeah. All right, thank you. Any follow-up questions? A lot. You've been busy. If not, thank you, Ms. Oliver, for being here.
Thank you.
I was going to have, since we have time for everybody to talk about their summer. But one of our members got married, and I was going to talk to him about telling us about getting married, and now he left us. I think he heard I was going to do that. So we'll forego all of that for another day. Don't warn them. Don't tell them. But I do thank you for being here. I appreciate your being willing to be on this committee. And I look forward to some interesting hearings in the weeks to come. And another one will be interesting tomorrow. We're going to talk about the regions process, the selection process. We'll have a number of testifiers here, and I should have a good discussion on whether that can be improved or not. So think about it. And if there are no other questions, 5 after 4, we're adjourned.